The holidays are almost here. And if you still have names in your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that are meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists or small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers and sports fans to foodies, mixologists, gardeners, and even the morbid curious. So you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give $1 back to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. I bought my girlfriend this awesome handcrafted nightlight for her office, which I'm super excited to watch her unwrap. And don't worry, she doesn't listen to this show. Something about, like, she already hears enough about me talking about ghosts at breakfast or something. I don't know. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/hauntings. That's uncommongoods.com/hauntings for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
July 1st, 1987, Southern Illinois. The kind of hot, still summer night where cicadas scream from the trees and gravel roads hold the day's heat like whispers that won't die. The kind of night where kids chase fireflies and where monsters sometimes walk in the open. Just after 9 p.m., a 10-year-old girl named Amy Rochelle Schultz slipped out of her family's small home in Cale, Illinois, a town of barely 200 people. She was looking for a runaway dog, looking for her brother, looking for anything except the nightmare waiting for her in the dark. Within hours, she would be abducted, beaten, strangled, raped, and murdered with a level of brutality that would scar the region for decades. And by sunrise the next morning, an oil-filled worker would stumble upon her body, face down in the dirt, naked, bleeding, and posed like someone wanted her to be found. This is not just a story about murder. It's a story about the failure of a small town's safety, the limits of forensic science, and the decades-long battle for justice that followed. It's also the story of a little girl who never got to go home. You're listening to American Dread, true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of the American heartland. This podcast is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. Today's story, Amy Schultz, 10 years old, 1987. Cale, Illinois sits quietly on the far eastern edge of Marion County. In 1987, it wasn't much more than a grid of gravel roads, a post office, a handful of houses, and silence. The kind of place where children riding their bike down the street is just a Tuesday, and where parents still leave their doors unlocked because nothing bad ever happens here. Except that year, something was shifting. Violent crime in rural Illinois had risen nearly 22% from 1984 to 1987. Child abductions nationwide were climbing with an estimated 67,000 attempted non-family abductions reported that year. Southern Illinois was seeing an uptick in sex crime cases, especially in towns under 5,000 people where law enforcement were stretched thin. But in Cale believed it was untouched, safe, untouchable, until the night before 4th of July weekend, the night Amy Schultz disappeared. At around 8:45 p.m., Amy's family dog bolted from the house. Amy's brother chased after it. When he didn't come back, Amy, 10 years old, shy, caring, always eager to help, stepped outside to look for him. No one could have known it was the last time anyone in Kale would see her alive. At 9:10 to 9:15 p.m., multiple people reported seeing Amy walking alone near Jefferson Street, close to 4th. A normal sight on a summer night, but every single one of those witnesses would later say the same thing. She looked like she was in a hurry. Less than an hour later, somewhere between 9:30 and 11 p.m., Amy was murdered. But no one knew that yet. At this point, Kale had only one truth. Amy was missing. Families spilled out in their houses with flashlights. Parents searched fields on foot. Volunteers combed the graveled roads. But the darkness swallowed everything. There was no sign of Amy, not even the dog she'd gone looking for. And while the town searched, her killer was just a few miles away, finishing what he'd started. The next morning would bring the kind of horror Southern Illinois had never seen. July 2nd, 1987. The sun had barely risen when an oil-filled worker headed down an isolated access road outside of Dix, Illinois, a rural patch of Jefferson County, more familiar with pump jacks and soybeans than death scenes. He'd driven that path hundreds of times. But today, something was wrong. A shape, small, still, out of place against the brown dirt and trampled weeds. He slowed the truck, opened the door, took a few hesitant steps forward, and then froze. The body of a child lay face down in the dirt, nude, covered in soil, blood drained in a wide halo beneath her neck. That worker would never forget what he saw. Few people would ever speak of it aloud, but the official reports preserved the truth. And the truth was worse than anyone imagined. Amy Schultz was found roughly 100 feet off an oil lease access road, the kind of hidden pull-off where a predator could stop a car without being seen, where headlights wouldn't reach, where a scream would never echo back. Her body showed signs of staging. Someone had tried to brush the dirt over her, not to hide her, but to mark her. To obscure what he'd done just enough that the details would belong only to him and the autopsy table. Investigators immediately noticed something critical. There was a shoe print on Amy's back, not just beside her, not a stumble, but a deliberate, full-weighted footprint pressed into the skin of a murdered child. They also found several pubic hairs lodged in a rectal area, placed there by a violent assault. A slit across her neck so deep the spinal column was visible, and scattered along the gravel road leading away from her, her shirt, her shorts, her underwear, her socks, her shoes, discarded like trash. Nearly 17 feet from her body, tire impressions. Beside them, a boot print matching the one pressed into her back. The brutality was unmistakable. The cruelty was personal. Amy had not just been killed, she had been attacked violently and drained of life like someone wanted her suffering to last. And this was only the beginning. On July 3rd, 1987, Dr. Steven Nurberger performed Amy's autopsy. What he found became the forensic roadmap for the entire investigation. Her throat had been slit with a wound 14.5 centimeters long, running from the center of her throat to behind her right ear, deep enough to sever her main artery and the jugular vein and cut into the cartilage near the vertebrae. Her right eye was hemorrhaged, her ear partially torn from the base, her lips ripped open from being crushed against her own teeth, evidence of pressure, force, and panic. Internally, the damage was staggering. 3 separate hemorrhages inside the skull, fractured rib, a torn liver, hemorrhaged vocal cord suggesting she screamed or was struggling with immense force, tears in the rectal area, soil and debris embedded in skin abrasions suggesting outdoor assault, The doctor would conclude she was strangled to death, sexually assaulted while incapacitated. Her throat was slit, and the killer stepped on her back to force the blood out of her body. A child, 10 years old, left face down in the dirt while her killer pushed the life from her. Time of death, between 9:30 and 11 p.m., just an hour, maybe less, after the last sighting of her alive. The timeline was tight, which meant that her killer was familiar with the area, comfortable in the dark, and had a place to flee to quickly. The news shattered Kel like a brick through stained glass. Parents pulled their kids inside. Churches opened for vigils. A neighborhood watch sprung up overnight. Dozens of people armed with nothing but fear and flashlights. No one allowed their children outside alone anymore, not even for a minute. The innocence of rural Illinois, that belief that nothing bad happens here, evaporated in a single morning. But investigators were already building a picture. Key evidence recovered at the scene: tire tracks, boot prints, pubic hair, over 30 dog hairs on Amy's clothing, 29 gold fibers on her clothes, foreign fibers in her shirt and shorts. No fingerprints, no witnesses, no confession, no DNA testing yet, not in 1987. But everything recovered told a story pointing toward a man who had already crossed paths with the law, a man who lived just minutes away from where Amy was found. And months later, that man would show up over 1,600 miles away in the mountains of Montana, firing a rifle at a federal park ranger. His name was Cecil Sutherland, and investigators were about to piece together a nightmare trail that led straight to him. In the weeks after Amy's murder, Jefferson County investigators chased leads that went nowhere. Strangers, drifters, sex offenders passing through, locals with alibis that didn't quite click, but nothing stuck. The case sat in a strange, awful limbo. A child brutally killed, a town paralyzed with fear, and no suspects strong enough to charge. That changed 5 months later, over 1,000 miles away in the cold, jagged wilderness of Montana. On November 19, 1987, rangers at Glacier National Park responded to gunfire echoing through the trees. A man with a rifle was firing at them from a wooded ridge. It turned into a chaotic confrontation. Officers ducked behind boulders. Bullets cracked through the pine branches. Visitors were evacuated. This wasn't a lost hunter or a panic hiker. This was a man who wanted to kill. When officers finally subdued him, the shooter gave his name: Cecil Sutherland, a 32-year-old drifter, unemployed, violent history, former maintenance worker from Dix, Illinois, a town 5 minutes from the road where Amy was found. His car, a 1977 Plymouth Fury, sat abandoned nearby. Inside it, rangers found dog hair, a pair of Texas steer boots, maps, survival gear, weapons, clothing, and the unmistakable wrenched smell of someone who had been living out of the vehicle. When the Glacier authorities ran his info through the NCIC, the machine spat back a request: urgent, contact Jefferson County, Illinois. Investigators in Illinois felt a chill. Sutherland wasn't just from the area. He lived in the same region, on the Kell-Dix line. He drove the gravel roads where Amy was abducted. He matched the profile that the doctor described, strong enough to overpower and lift a struggling 10-year-old, violently enough to commit extreme violence. But one detail mattered more than another, and that was the right front tire of his car. It was a model called Cooper Falls, one of only two tire models in North America that matched the impression pulled from Amy's crime scene. Just one tire on the right front wheel, exactly where the cast impression had been deepest. For the first time since Amy vanished, police had a suspect who made sense. Illinois State Police forensic scientist David Brundridge compared plaster casts from the crime scene, ink impressions from Sutherland's tire, and the Cooper tire manufacturing blueprints. He concluded The tire impressions could have been made by Sutherland's tire. Not did, not must have, but could have. And yet, when Cooper Tire's mold operation manager ran his own assessment, he said the probability would be the same model as Sutherland's tire was pretty great. Still not proof, but enough to keep investigators from looking away. Then came the dog hair. On Amy's clothing, her socks, underwear, shirt, shorts, investigators had found 34 dog hairs. Under microscope, they did not match her family's three dogs. They did not match her grandparents' dog. They did not match the neighbor's dog. But they did match Sutherland's black Labrador, Babe. Even more compelling, a relative testified that Babe was always in Sutherland's car, to the point where it was impossible to sit in the vehicle without being covered in hair. Amy had never met Sutherland, but her clothes were covered in hair from his dog. Next came the fibers. On Amy's clothing, investigators collected 29 gold fibers found on her socks, shoe, underwear, shorts, and shirt. Microscopes revealed that 28 of the 29 could have originated from the carpet in Sutherland's vehicle. One additional fiber could have come from the upholstery of the same car. Inside Sutherland's car, on the passenger seat and floor, forensic scientists found cotton and polyester fibers consistent with Amy's shirt and shorts. And again, not a 100% match, but scientifically considering the size, shape, color, diameter, and the optical properties, which meant this: Amy had likely been inside Sutherland's vehicle. But even that wasn't the most disturbing piece. Two pubic hairs recovered from Amy's private areas were analyzed against every male in her family. 24 suspects, known offenders in the region. Only one person could not be excluded: Cecil Sutherland. It wasn't DNA, not yet, but in 1987, microscopic hair comparison was standard, and these hairs matched Sutherland's. That made him the only man out of nearly 30 tested who could have deposited those hairs. And if hair had transferred to her body, then he had been close enough, physically, sexually, to assault her. The boot print found on Amy's back and near her body matched the design of a boot sold by Kmart called Texas Steer. Months after the murder, when Sutherland was arrested in Montana, he had a pair of those boots with him. Not the same pair, but the same brand. The same style, the same outsole pattern. The prosecutors would later use that to argue he had a preference for that brand. The defense would counter years later that he didn't even buy those boots until after Amy's murder. But in 1987, that detail looked damning. Then came the alibi. Sutherland's family tried to anchor him with a timeline. 8 to 8:30 p.m. left his brother's home in Texaco. 10:57 called his mother from Harper's gas station in Mount Vernon. Gas attendant said he'd been there for probably about 20 to 30 minutes already. Jefferson County deputies calculated the distance. Kell to the crime scene, 12.1 miles, 14 minutes. Crime scene to Harper's station, 20.4 miles, 22 minutes. Meaning, if he left Texaco by 8:30, he had more than enough time to abduct Amy around 9:10, assault her and murder her between 9:30 and 11, and still arrive at the gas station when he did. The timeline didn't save him. It failed to prove even the illusion of her innocence. Investigators now had tire evidence, dog hair evidence, pubic hair evidence, gold fiber evidence, boot print evidence, vehicle fiber transfers, a violent history, and an alibi that left a canyon of opportunity. And then one more detail. A family member testified that Sutherland had sexually abused him years earlier, a 16-year-old victim willing to speak. By 1988, everything pointed to one man, the monster from Dix, Cecil Sutherland. By early 1988, word spread fast across southern Illinois. Jefferson County deputies were preparing to bring Cecil Sutherland back from Montana, not for shooting at the Rangers in Glacier National Park, but for the rape and murder of 10-year-old Amy Schultz. For Kell, for Dix, for Jefferson County, this wasn't just an arrest. It was relief, justice, revenge. People wanted answers. They wanted closure. They wanted a face, a villain to blame for the kind of violence no one had prepared for. Sutherland's face fit the role perfectly. Long hair, rough beard, unemployed, drifter, violent, convicted sex offender, a man who shot at federal officers, a man who lived minutes from the crime scene. When he stepped off the transport vehicle in Jefferson County, wrist cuffed, eyes hollow, locals lined the sidewalk just to stare at the man accused of destroying their peace. Some cursed, some prayed, some watched, but no one was neutral. Police interrogated Sutherland, but he denied everything. Cool, flat, emotionless. Even as they read him the autopsy findings, the strangulation, the assault, the stabbing, he barely blinked. No confession, no remorse, nothing. But investigators weren't deterred. They had a mountain of evidence and a community screaming for justice. Within weeks, prosecutors charged him with first-degree murder, aggravated criminal sexual assault, aggravated kidnapping, and they made something else very clear. They would seek the death penalty. But before the jury could be chosen, something unexpected happened. The defense argued legitimately that Sutherland couldn't get a fair trial in Jefferson County. The media had saturated the region. People in Kell and Dix were on the edge. Shockingly, the judge agreed. At first, the trial was set to move to Sangamon County, far from the emotional blast radius of southern Illinois. But then, quietly behind closed doors, the Chief Justice intervened. He suggested costs, logistics, and other concerns, and encouraged the trial judge to reconsider. The trial was shifted to Richland County, just 75 miles away. Still southern Illinois, still close enough that everyone had heard of Amy's name. The defense objected, hard, repeatedly, but the decision held. It would be one of the many choices that later courts would question. 92% of potential juries admitted they had already known about the case. One-third said they believed Sutherland was guilty before hearing a single word of evidence. Those people were dismissed, but their presence told a real story. You couldn't find someone in that region who hadn't already formed an opinion. Still, 12 jurors were sworn in, and the trial began. Prosecutors built their case like a staircase, one step at a time. Step 1, the timeline. Sutherland had a window of opportunity between 8:30 p.m. and his 10:57 p.m. gas station call. Step 2, the tire impressions. His car front right tire could have made the print of the scene. Step 3, the dog hair. 34 hairs on Amy's clothing matched his dog, Babe. Step 4, the pubic hairs. 2 hairs recovered from Amy's nude body were consistent with his and no one else. Step 5, the golden fibers. 28 gold fibers could have come from the car's carpet. Step 6, the reverse transfer. Fibers from Amy's clothes were found in Sutherland's car. Step 7, the boots. The Texas Steer boot print matched the pattern of boots he would later own. Step 8, the proximity. He lived close. He had a history with kids. He had a violent record. To the jurors, it built a picture. Not perfect. Not airtight. But overwhelming. And then came the emotional torque wrench. One of his own family members, a teenage relative, testified that Sutherland had sexually abused him 10 years earlier. The courtroom froze. Jurors stared at Sutherland like they were looking at a wolf in human skin. Even though his abuse had nothing to do with Amy's case, in their eyes, it proved he was a monster. But Sutherland's public defender, James Hansen, tried to fight back. He questioned the hair analyst. He questioned the fiber analyst. He questioned whether the tire could match thousands of other tires on the road. But the jury didn't hear what they needed to. Critical evidence was never shown to them. Receipts showing that Sutherland didn't buy the Texas Steer boots till after Amy's murder. Testimony that the tires on the car had been changed twice after July 1987. Notes from the investigators showing someone else had given Sutherland an alibi until 10:30 p.m. The entire uncomfortable truth about Amy's step-grandfather, who lived 100 yards from home and would later be convicted of sex crimes. None of this made it in. Not because it was supposed to, but because the defense failed to present it. Years later, this would become one of the main reasons the Illinois Supreme Court overturned the verdict. But in 1989, the jury heard one message loud and clear. This man could have killed Amy, and that's good enough. The jury would step out, but not for long. They would return within an hour. They found Cecil Sutherland guilty of murder, guilty of aggravated kidnapping, guilty of aggravated criminal sexual assault. Then came the sentencing phase. Prosecutors shown pictures of Amy's body. They read the autopsy details again. They highlighted the cruelty, and with almost no hesitation, the jury sentenced him to death. For Cale, Illinois, the nightmare was over. The monster was caged. Justice was served. Or so they thought. What no one knew, not yet, was the cracks were already forming in the foundation of the case. Cracks that would take more than a decade to shatter and send shockwaves to the entire Illinois justice system. The case against Cecil Sutherland should have been open and shut. A 10-year-old child murdered with unimaginable brutality, a suspect with a violent past, hair, fibers, dog fur, tire impressions, circumstantially threads woven together into something that looked, at first glance, airtight. But the thing about threads, when you pull hard enough on one, the whole thing can come apart. And in the late 1980s, that's exactly what began to happen. In the early months after Sutherland's arrest, something strange began turning up in interviews, and it came from his own family. A handful of relatives and friends insisted that Cecil didn't even own the famous boots. Ones with the tread supposedly matching the shoe print found on Amy's back until after her murder. And the tires, those Cooper Falls, the state said matched the crime scene plaster cast. They claimed those two were put on his car after July 1st, 1987. The timeline suddenly wasn't so tidy. Were they protecting him? Were they telling the truth? Or was it just noise in a small Southern Illinois community reeling from the horror? No one knew for sure, but the seed of doubt had been planted. The original trial took place in 1989, 2 years after the murder. It had to be moved, not because no one cared, but because everyone did. The fear in Kell and Dix and Mount Vernon was so intense, the judge relocated the proceedings to Richland County. Even so, when the jury selected started, 92% of potential jurors said they'd already heard about the case. It didn't matter. The trial moved forward, and the state presented its evidence. The fibers, the dog hairs, the pubic hair, the tire tracks. Something happened that would come back to haunt this case for decades. The prosecution overstated everything. Not could have come from. Not consistent with. Not possible source. They told juries things were matches, absolutely, certain, exact, but the scientists never said that, ever. In the 1980s, they didn't have cutting-edge forensic tools, and the FBI has admitted that over 90% of its hair-matching testimonies for decades was scientifically unsound, and that's exactly the kind of evidence used to convict Cecil Sutherland. Two pubic hairs, consistent with him. A handful of dog hairs, similar to his dog. Gold fibers that could have come from his vehicle. Cotton fibers that might have matched Amy's shirt, even though the defense experts saw differences. But the biggest cracks weren't in the evidence. They were in the Sutherland's defense. His public defender failed to present testimony that could have undercut two of the biggest pillars of the state's case, the tire tracks. Multiple people were prepared to testify Sutherland didn't have those tires until after Amy's murder. The boot print. Again, witnesses said that he did not own those boots at that time. And this was coming from friends and immediate family. People who knew what he wore and drove. And the jury? Never heard a word of it. Not one syllable. And then on December 4th, 1992, the Supreme Court issued a stunning decision. They overturned Sutherland's conviction. Not because they thought he was innocent. Not because the evidence pointed somewhere else. But because the process, the justice system, had been broken. The court ruled his attorneys failed to introduce critical testimony. The state overstepped their forensic evidence boundaries. Key statements made during the closing arguments were improper, and the jury was misled by science presented at certain times when it wasn't. A death sentence, the ultimate punishment, had been built on a flawed testimony and crippled defense. To the court, that was unacceptable. Sutherland was ordered a new trial, and for the first time in 5 years, the Schultz family had to face the possibility that Amy's killer might walk free. By the early 1990s, Southern Illinois was a community exhausted by grief. Kell had fewer than 300 residents. Jefferson County saw a violent crime rate spike through the mid-1980s and 40% increase between 1983 and 1987, mirroring a statewide surge. In the year that Amy died, Illinois recorded over 1,000 murders, a record at the time. Children were disappearing or being targeted at nearly double the rate of the previous decade. Parents were terrified, people were angry, and when the conviction was thrown out, shockwaves hit every home in Kell, Dix, and Mount Vernon. Had the wrong man been convicted? Or was a brutal child killer about to slip through the cracks of the legal system? Either answer was horrifying. In early 1993, Sutherland was returned from prison to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department. Reporters lined the sidewalks. Cameras flashed. Deputies formed a wall around him. He walked into the courthouse, shackled but confident, and told the judge, "I will represent myself." The courtroom fell silent. He fired his public defender, rejected assistance, and prepared to stand alone. A man accused of rape, mutilation, and the murder of a 10-year-old child. Against the entire weight of the state of Illinois, whatever he was, guilty or innocent, Cecil Sutherland was not afraid. Not of the state, not of the jury, not even of death itself. And that made him even more dangerous to the prosecutors, to the community, and most of all, to the truth. Because now the question looming over Southern Illinois was, if the system got it wrong once, could it get it wrong again? When Cecil Sutherland walked back into Jefferson County early in 1993, he didn't look like the man awaiting retrial for one of the most brutal child murders in Illinois history. He looked composed, calm, almost comfortable. And that unraveled everyone. He had spent years on death row, years isolated, years studying his own case, years waiting for a second chance, and now that chance has arrived. When Sutherland told the judge he would represent himself, court officials exchanged uneasy looks. It wasn't uncommon for defenders to fire their attorneys, but it was rare, almost unheard of, for a man facing capital murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault of a child to walk into a court alone, by choice. Sutherland insisted he didn't need a lawyer. He would cross-examine witnesses himself, challenge forensic experts personally, argue every inch of his innocence with his own voice. To the community, it felt like an insult. To the prosecutors, it was a complication. To Amy's family, it was a nightmare they prayed that never have to live through again. They had buried their child. They had sat through a year of trial proceedings. They had watched a jury deliver a guilty verdict and a death sentence. And now, they were back at the beginning. The retrial preparations drug on for years, though. This time, the state knew it had to rebuild its case from the foundation up. No shortcuts this time. They went back to it. The fibers, the dog hairs, the pubic hairs, the tire impressions, the shoe print, and the timeline. Each piece of evidence was reassessed with the late 90s forensic methods. Some details sharpened, others blurred, but the case remained chilling. This wasn't a mystery built on suspicion. It wasn't a ghost story or an urban legend. This was a crime scene soaked in blood, mud, fibers, and tear, and the forensic tale still led back to Sutherland. Between the first trial in 1989 and the retrial preparations of the late 1990s, forensic science had transformed. DNA testing had gone from experimental to essential. Hair analysis, once treated as gospel, were now questioned. Fibers were looked at differently, and the violent crime investigation procedures were undergoing nation reform. This time, analysts used improved technology to re-examine what little biological material remained. Results were grim. The dog hairs on Amy's clothing were still consistent with Sutherland's dog, Babe. The fibers were still a match to his car carpet and seats. The small remaining hairs still excluded every other family member, neighbors, and suspect except Sutherland. And Sutherland himself. In an earlier statement, he had admitted to strangling a child until she passed out, though he attempted later to recant and reinterpret what he said. Individually, none of it was conclusive. Together, it was a web. A web that wrapped tighter with every retest, every new lab report, every modern review. The late 90s were anxious years for Southern Illinois. Parents who lived through Amy's murder still walked their children to school. People locked their doors earlier. The memory of 1987 still lived in every shadow. Local newspapers kept the case alive. Sutherland awaits new trial. Evidence revisited. Child killer to represent himself. Residents whispered that he would walk free. Others said he'd never leave state custody alive. Some wondered if someone else could have done it. A few cursed the justice system entirely. And then, finally, after years of motions, hearings, evaluations, and forensic evidence, the retrial began. It opened quietly. No screaming crowds, no riots, just a worn-down courtroom filled with police, lawyers, and reporters, and Amy's family fighting to stay composed. The prosecution laid out the evidence again, calmly, not overstating, not exaggerating, just presented plainly and plainly horrifying. They reconstructed Amy's final night. The look on her face as she walked to find her brother. The moment she crossed paths with the killer. The violent struggle, the strangulation, the sexual assault, the throat wound that opened her neck to her spine. They walked the jury through every injury. Torn lips, damaged vocal cords, fractured rib, torn liver, tearing of the rectal area, the severing of the main artery, the pool of blood where she died, the shoe prints pressed into her back, the dirt packed into her wounds. And for the first time since 1987, jurors heard all of it through scientific clarity, not an emotional fog. When it came time for the defense to speak, all eyes turned to the man at the table. No attorney, no advocate, just Cecil Edward Sutherland. He approached the juror like it was a lecture. Calm, polite, almost disconnected from the brutality of the case. He attacked the forensic evidence. He questioned the integrity of the investigators. He challenged timelines. He insisted conspiracies. He suggested contamination, coincidence, but something was missing, something the jury could feel. There was no humanity in him, no grief, no sorrow, no outrage at being accused of killing a child, nothing, just cold logic. cold distance and at a child murder trial, that vacuum is louder than any confession. After weeks of testimony and after hours of debating, the jury filed back into the courtroom. The verdict was read: guilty, all counts, again. For the second time in his life, Cecil Edward Southern was convicted of the kidnapping, sexual assault, and murder of 10-year-old Amy Schultz. And again, the jury chose death. In their eyes, the retrial, the correct forensic approaching, the improved science, the expanded timeline only solidified what Southern Illinois had already known. This was not the wrong man. This was Amy's killer. And yet, the story still wasn't over, because Illinois itself was about to change in a way no one saw coming. When Cecil Southern was convicted a second time, the courtroom breathed with relief. Justice, bruised, battered, delayed, had finally stood upright again. And when the judge pronounced the sentence, death, many people believed the story was ending. But in Illinois, the 1990s were not a stable decade for capital punishment. It was a storm, one fueled by wrongful convictions, false confessions, and cases collapsing under the weight of bad forensic and even worse investigations. A storm that would eventually change the fate of every man on death row, including the man who murdered Amy Schultz. Between 1987 and 1999, Illinois executed just 3 men, but 13 death row inmates were exonerated, more than the number executed. Some have been tortured by Chicago police. Some have been railroaded by corrupt detectives. Some had confessions beaten out of them. Some had scientific evidence mispresented, the same kind of microscopic hair comparison junk science that had been used in Sutherland's first trial. By 1999, the system was collapsing under its own weight, and then came the case that changed everything. Anthony Porter, a mentally disabled man 2 days from execution, proven innocent by college students. Illinois was shaken, the legal community was shaken, and Governor George Ryan began questioning everything he believed about justice. In January 2000, Governor Ryan did the unthinkable. He declared a moratorium on all executions in Illinois. No one would be put to death until the system could be trusted. But that was only the beginning. Over the next 3 years, Ryan reviewed case after case. Hidden evidence, jailhouse snitches, bad forensic, bad confessions, bad police, prosecutional misconduct, and more wrongful convictions than anyone wanted to admit. The house of cards were crumbling, and in January 2003, George Ryan made history. He commuted the sentence of every single death row inmate in the state, more than 160 of them, Sutherland included, from death to life without parole. It was one of the largest acts of clemency in American history, and one of the most controversial. People cheered, people screamed. Some called Ryan a hero, others called him a traitor. But one person, one father, felt the impact of that decision like a blow to the chest. When the news reached Dennis Schultz, Amy's father, he didn't soften. He didn't mince words. He didn't speak like a politician or a lawyer. He spoke like a father, and he said, "It's unspeakable." Like he's saying, "What happened to my daughter doesn't matter." He said Illinois politicians were weak cowards, more concerned with killers than victims. He spent years fighting to keep the death penalty alive. He showed up for hearings, met the lawmakers, gave interviews, pushed for reform. But Illinois had made up its mind. In July 2011, the death penalty was abolished entirely. From that day on, Cecil Edward Southern would never face execution for what he did to Amy. Never face the same terror he inflicted. Never face the same helplessness she endured. Never face the finality of justice her family believed he deserved. Instead, he would simply sit in a cell for life. But this story, Amy's story, did not disappear into the legal system. Something powerful grew from the place where the little girl's life was taken. Her father, Dennis, refused to let her name be something whispered in sorrow. He turned it into a shield, a weapon, a beacon. The Amy Center, the Amy Schultz Child Advocate Center, opened in Mount Vernon. Its mission: protect abused children, give them a safe place to speak, fight for justice, prevent what happened to Amy from ever happening again. For every child that walks through the door, Amy has been there. Her story, her memory, her name, living on in every single caseworker, interview, and rescue. And in that way, she became larger than any horror that took her. But here's the truth Southern Illinois never forgets. On July 1st, 1987, a 10-year-old girl walked out to find her brother. She never came home. The brutality she suffered was beyond anything a child or human should ever endure. And the man convicted twice of killing her tried every possible avenue to escape accountability. Appeal after appeal, motion after motion, claiming misconduct, bad science, bad lawyers, bad judges. But none of them changed what happened to Amy. Her injuries didn't change. The timeline didn't change. The forensic trail didn't change. The truth didn't change. A monster crossed paths with a child that night, and he left his violence written across her body forever. Today, Cecil Edward Sutherland sits in the Illinois Department of Correctionals, not on death row, but in the closest thing Illinois has left. A life sentence with no hope of release, no appeals left that he can undo what the courts have already upheld, no chance of ever stepping foot in Southern Illinois again. But it isn't his name that matters, it's hers. Amy Schultz, 10 years old, February 1977 through July 1st, 1987. A child stolen, a community shattered, a justice system tested, a legacy born from loss, and the heart of one of the darkest cases in American dread. What happened to Amy wasn't just a crime, it was a wound, a tear in the fabric of a small Southern Illinois town, a place where kids rode their bikes past cornfields, where everyone knew your dog's name, where a summer night should have been safe, and yet, in the middle of that innocent, a monster was waiting. Illinois would argue about this case for decades, from Jefferson County courtrooms to the Illinois Supreme Court, from death row to across the board communications, from the protest outside the Capitol to the final abolishing of the death penalty. But none of that, not the appeals, not the politicians, not the court rulings, ever changed what mattered most. A little girl never got to grow up. She never made it to middle school, never had her first dance, never had her first car, never had a future. And her family had to bury what was left of her childhood in a cemetery instead of watching her grow. Amy's name should have faded into cold case files like so many others, but it didn't. Not because the system worked, but because her father refused to let it die. And because of that, thousands of kids across Southern Illinois now step into her room with child advocates, counselors, investigators who believe them, who protect them, who speak for them, all because of Amy. Her story echoes in every hallway of the Amy Center. It echoes in every interview room, in every child who finds safety because someone refused to forget. And that's the thing about these stories, the ones we tell here on American Dread. They don't end clean. They don't wrap up neatly. Justice isn't always justice, and the monsters don't always pay the price we wish they would. But the victims, they deserve to be remembered. They deserve to have their stories told, and they deserve more than silence. Thank you for listening to American Dread, true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of American heartland. This podcast is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. I'm Adam White.